You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Stephen Amsterdam's Things We Didn't See Coming is a collection of linked short stories about a narrator who faces almost every imaginable disaster, floods, droughts, famine, and a viral pandemic in a post-apocalyptic future. It won the Book of the Year Award for 2009 from the Australian newspaper The Age, and it's being published in this country by Pantheon. I'm very pleased to welcome Stephen Amsterdam to our show. Hello. Oh,
thank you for having me.
Now, you were born and raised here in New York. How did you end up in Australia?
New Yorkers aren't supposed to leave, but I did. I was working for a travel publisher for a long time and ended up knowing people in Melbourne and Sydney, and I had a very kind boss at one moment who let me take a month off, which is not a very usual thing, and I got to travel there.
So when you were traveling around, did you think you were searching for a place where you might feel more comfortable?
No, not particularly. I wasn't. It was just general wanderlust, and as working for a travel company, you get to go all over, but it was landing in Melbourne and just feeling like home, which you're not. Those are one of those feelings you're not supposed to honor as a traveler.
No, especially the south of France or someplace like that.
Right, or Hawaii. It's someplace obvious.
But, so how long have you lived in Melbourne?
7 years.
And you have a couple of chickens? Do they allow you to keep chickens in the middle of town?
It's not quite the middle of the town. I'm actually living a suburban existence. So you're allowed to have chickens. You're not allowed to have roosters. You need a license for a rooster.
Because they make noise.
Yes.
Most of your stories are set in rural areas rather than in cities.
That wasn't an intentional thing, but what I found when I was writing was I kept wanting to kind of escape the typical futuristic Blade Runner kind of city or Brazil kind of city that was destroyed in the usual way. And I think it's hard to picture the rural environment changing as much as it might, so the trip to the country seems like a natural place to go to.
There's a section on your website called "What Are You So Worried About?" and you list items like population explosion, voter apathy, reef erosion as things to worry about. Are you a natural worrier?
Yes, Upper West Side New Yorker, and it's deep in the blood, but trying to get over it, and I think the Australian lifestyle is a little bit good for that.
Well, are these stories a way of dealing with that? Because here you envision a world where the Y2K computer breakdown actually happened. I guess you were thinking about what would have happened if that hadn't been worked out.
Mm. I felt that by exploring these worries, it seemed like each chapter is almost a different worry of what we're programmed to worry about right now, these pandemics or the flooding and all that. And writing the book in some ways was a way to exercise a lot of these fears. And a friend reminded me how worried I was when, do you remember West Nile virus?
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to be terrified. And the
SARS came along.
And SARS, H1N1. And it's possible to keep worrying. If you have a steady, there's an economy of worry in your blood, and you can always keep it pretty high.
Although there's an alternative theory that after a while, after they don't turn out to be as dangerous as was predicted, we stop worrying. I guess we have to be reminded that the Spanish influenza killed lots and lots of people. That was during World War I.
Right. But so far, we're fine.
The world in these stories is a familiar one at the beginning and then slowly becomes unrecognizable. Did your vision of the future reveal itself as you were writing?
I wrote these stories out of order. And
were you writing them as short stories or with the idea that they would all be put together?
After I wrote the first story that I wrote for the book, was inspired by a newspaper article, and a lot of these were actually inspired by things I've read in the newspaper and in the Economist. So they're more items that are about to happen or things that we could see in the foreseeable future. I'm not going 20 years out into we're all living under a dome and flying around with jetpacks. I'm trying to imagine things that are quite imaginable.
Well, although you've called the book Things We Didn't See Coming, which I guess we could say about everything in past history as well.
Mm.
I mean, nobody could have predicted that we would have computers, these very thin computers that we can put in our laps and write on or connect to the rest of the world while we sit having a cappuccino.
Right.
Or a latte. I wouldn't have even known what a latte was 20 years ago.
Exactly. And I ordered one because coffee ordering in Melbourne is much different than in New York. So when I ordered mine today, I was a little concerned that they wouldn't understand what I was saying or what I was after. But the title for Things We Didn't See Coming is almost ironic because these are all things that we... books about the future tend to be really books about the present. Mm-hmm. So these are our worries right now. In 20 years, these will not be our worries.
You have one narrator for all the stories. Why did you want to do it that way? It sounds to me like you were really thinking novel.
I wanted to string them together. It was marketed in Australia as a novel, and it's going to be marketed in the UK as a novel.
But here, connected short
stories. Here, connected short stories, because people are apparently less scared of the short story.
Well, we've seen quite a few collections in which that approach is taken. In fact, yesterday I was speaking to Amy Bloom, who has two series of connected short stories in her latest book.
I find it an interesting way to follow a narrative without... I find a novel is almost too hard sometimes to sustain. And I think if you go into a person's life at different moments, you can get the important bits, the parts that you do want to read, and kind of it's up to the reader then to keep track of the other parts, the overall arc of the book.
Many people assume that a first-person narrator is a stand-in for the author. Does that apply when you're writing about the future?
I don't think that anyone's going to read this and say this is exactly Stephen. The narrator has probably some of my habits. And certainly the first person voice is going to be a bit mine, but I've definitely had people read it to me and say, I didn't see you in here at all.
You have thought a lot about just how terrible things could be in a world in which everything goes wrong, never-ending drought, incredibly barren landscapes. I'm assuming that's because you've gone into the center of Australia at some point or another. Your characters have to endure a variety of unpleasant climate conditions. In one story, there's a dry, barren heat with little or no water. Another, there's incessant rain. At times, they live on things like rats, bark, twigs, lizards, ferns, wild mushrooms, leaves. I wonder if you've eaten any of these things as research and how you know that rat, when fried, becomes stringy.
Actually, that detail, it was a guess. I have a very useful book at home called How to Survive in the Wilderness, and that's I'm still at heart a New Yorker and scared of bugs, so most of the roughing it was research. My toughness has limits.
My guest is Stephen Amsterdam, and his first book, a collection of short stories called Things We Didn't See Coming, has been published by Pantheon in this country. The narrator is a thief throughout his life. Do you think that this is the only way for him to survive?
It's an interesting question. I think he struggles with that element of himself. He doesn't want to quite be as dishonest as he frequently has to be, but he's an artful dodger of sorts and does what he has to do to survive and always keeps one eye on the exit door and sometimes has to keep one eye on where the little pile of money is or what his girlfriend's up to. There's, I don't like to say thief, but deceptive or self-protective to an extent that might not seem to us as quite moral.
Well, he has various jobs in government. Mm-hmm. That automatically makes him a matter of suspicion, doesn't it?
I have two family members who work for the city of New York, so I have to be careful here.
Don't you have a day job as a psychiatric nurse?
I do.
Has that given you a rather negative view of the workings of human nature, the human heart?
Not at all. Not at all. It's given me, I think one of the best things it gives me is the variety of human experience. It's very easy for a writer to live at home with their friends, with the world coming to them through the internet or phone, and going to work every day is a magnificent opportunity to meet with people who've been through all sorts of traumas and ex- very different experiences of the world.
We don't want to give the impression that the vision here is totally grim. Your narrator has a wry sense of humor. There are many funny things that happen in this book.
He has a distance, and I think that comes a little bit from his deceptiveness that keeps him kind of looking at for incongruence in his world.
Are you known in Australia as a writer first or as a psychiatric nurse who writes short stories?
It depends. It's strange going to, I got that nice award and then I went to work the next day and patients don't always treat you so well on a psychiatric ward. And I wanted to I had a very nice weekend. Why is this happening?
So, and they hadn't read the paper and were totally unaware?
Pretty much. No, they have other concerns when they're on an acute ward.
I was reminded of Margaret Mead, who used to argue for marriage as something that where the contract should be similar to a driver's license where you should get a renewal. You have an 18-month contract that requires renewal forms here.
That seemed like a logical development of things, sort of a meeting halfway between the civil unions that people are pushing for now and the general possible dissatisfaction with marriage in the future and whatever, all the financial problems that come with the marriage contract. And so the unions that I imagine in that story seem like a rational way to go.
Some reviews have almost predictably compared your vision with Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Do you see that?
When I first brought this to my Australian publisher, the first thing they said to me was, have you read The Road? And I said, no. And they said, okay, don't. Because you'll have to answer just that question at some
point.
Have
you not read it since?
I haven't read it because...
Did you see the movie?
I haven't seen the movie because I don't want to have to say...
Read the classic comic?
Just the cliff notes. No, I just haven't wanted to have to say, oh, no, my book's much better this way. But, obviously he trumped me all over the place. I think the themes that people see are some of the family linkings in a rough environment. But I think the individual stories don't, to me, sound like what The Road is about.
Well, it's difficult if you write a post-apocalyptic novel or linked short stories when something else has come along that's similar. But nobody says to you when you write about two people who fall in love but can't make it work. Oh, well, Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet.
Right. The Road is obviously on people's minds at the moment, but I was working at this kind of in tandem, and it just takes me longer to reach a publisher than it does Cormac McCarthy.
There's a scene in one of the stories, The Forest for the Trees, where the characters are watching RoboCop. What's the significance of that film?
I think that's a little bit of my explanation for the fact that I wasn't trying to write a predictive novel. I was trying to, in the scene, the character was watching RoboCop and the narrator is amused by how wrong the director got it. The future doesn't look like that. And I just wanted to acknowledge that I don't expect any of this stuff to exactly happen.
Well, of course, 2001 came and we didn't have a space station with a huge computer. No, but the world didn't fall apart at that point. So what are you working on now?
A book about a family with special powers. And each family member gets their own story or chapter, depending on where it's marketed.
Stephen Amsterdam's collection of short stories, Things We Didn't See Coming, is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.